You are listening to the Navigating the Healthcare Neighbourhood podcast, episode 2. Today we are talking with Dr. Nwando Oleyawola from Rubicon MD in San Francisco, USA. Let's get started.
First of all, thank you for taking part in our podcast today. Our first question for you is, would you mind introducing yourself and just give us a quick overview of your work history?
All right, absolutely. My name is Dr. Nwando Oleyawola. I'm a family physician and currently work as the Chief Clinical Transformation Officer of Rubicon MD, which is an organization that connects primary care providers to specialty care providers using technology. Prior to that, I was the director of the University of California, San Francisco's Center for Excellence in Primary Care, where I was working on large-scale strategies to better improve primary care and optimize the way it was delivered, but also better position primary care in the larger medical neighborhood. And that was based on a lot of work that I had done in a position before that, where I was the chief medical officer of a large net centers in one of our northeastern states in the United States.
Great, okay. So the one of the key reasons that we wanted to involve you in some of our healthcare neighborhood work was your paper on facilitating care integration in community health centers. I personally found it a really interesting read. For the people who are listening to the podcast who perhaps haven't read it, can you perhaps give us an overview of how the paper came about and what it is that the paper is about?
Absolutely. Yeah. So thank you very much. The paper was spurred by this notion that the integration between the primary care medical home and all of the rest of the larger, what we call medical neighborhood, all the other different players that patients interact with, that clinicians interact with, the integration between all those different components is highly complex. And when you think about the fact that if you are providing primary care services to a patient, it is very likely that you would interact with hundreds of other care providers and people in the system of healthcare, but also outside of the system in multiple practices. You would expect that if that is going to be the necessity to communicate so often would require very good, robust systems that facilitate that kind of integration, but we just don't have them. And what happens is that patients end up feeling that they do not have well-coordinated care. They might have good care in a particular setting, in a hospital, in a community clinic, when they're in a skilled nursing facility, but anytime there's a transition between any of those places or information needs to get communicated between those different places, the system kind of breaks down. And so what we were looking at in this paper was, how do we really start to highlight what are some of the exemplars in integrating care in a larger medical neighborhood? And we thought we could do a few things. One, you know, how well are these community clinics integrated into surrounding medical neighborhoods? But what are the strategies that people have done to really overcome some of these challenges that I've described in care integration in the broader setting?
And you focused on five particular areas there, didn't you? So I've just got your paper in front of me.
Yeah, we focused on the interface between primary care and specialty care, oral health care, diagnostic imaging, pharmacy services, and hospital-based care. So we focused on those five domains and probably could have covered many others as well. But behavioral health was another one that came up. We ultimately did a focus on that afterwards, but the paper, the report, focused on those five domains.
Yeah.
And the reason why we chose those is because when you look at the places where primary care often interacts, it's in one of those large buckets.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and one of the things I found particularly useful when I was reading your paper was the conceptual model that you used. So I was wondering if you could perhaps talk us through how you came to the two, I guess, larger domains and then the five domains that sit under those.
Yeah. So when we think about Dr. Barbara Starfield, who's a well-known pediatrician and health economist, who really described primary care as having four major pillars. It's the first point of contact of care for people, at least in an ideal system. It provides continuity of care, comprehensive care to people for their whole being, and also well-coordinated care. We were trying to think of, we actually started off looking at innovations themselves. What are some strategies that people have been using to build these relationships? I'm thinking that the most important component, regardless of how you look at it, is relationships among all of these different people that are part of this larger system. And as we were looking at these different interventions and models and innovations that had been described, particularly with the goal of better integrating care under a larger medical neighborhood, we realized two themes started to show up a lot. One was that in some cases, the modality was really how do you bring services into the primary care setting? And we thought that aligned really well with the Starfield pillar of comprehensiveness, that you can create the primary care setting as a place where you have care that's coordinated in one place and services are built into this medical home that people know. But the other thing that we also started to see was people are also really thinking about, we don't have the capacity to take this on in primary care. Mm-hmm. We need relationships that exist outside of primary care. And so we started to see that really align very well with the Starford pillar of coordination. And so we broke these two things into either the services are being brought into primary care in a couple of ways, either by co-locating and bringing additional services into whatever that primary care setting is, or by building the capacity of the primary care provider and the care team to take on additional levels of work. So for example, building capacity among primary care providers to actually screen for behavioral health conditions, ask behavioral health questions, ask questions that a clinical pharmacist might ask, and building the capacity to do that in the primary care home. Whereas on the other side, the coordination was really building these relationships and building constructs to communicate with people outside of the primary care home. And that was largely manifest by, okay, we're not going to actually bring these services. So we're not going to bring an endocrinologist into the primary care home, or we can't possibly have the hospital come and be inside the primary care medical home. But we do need to have a very good system in which we communicate and collaborate with them, in which we have a network of service providers that are available to provide access, or we can help patients better navigate through the system. So those are the two streams, and then underneath those streams, the different models that we found.
My favorite bit of your paper was the case studies. I think they're fascinating, and I was wondering if you could tell us what you thought really stood out for you when you were putting it all together as a really great example for other people to look to for how integration can be done well.
Yeah, I'll tell you one, because it's the area of work that I've transitioned to since, and it was largely spurred out of this excitement about the opportunity to build networks and leverage technology in this medical neighborhood. So there, and it covered a number of those different things. So actually, when we're trying to classify this particular innovation, we end up feeling like it covered so many of those. It was kind mm-hmm. of on the comprehensiveness side, but also on the coordination side, and that's one through the electronic consultation model, which we've been using. Has been gaining a lot of steam in the United States over the past decade, but increasingly so in the last 3 or 4 years. Because what it does is it requires that you do a lot of the things that we talked about. So definitely defining the providers that are going to be connecting to the primary care network and developing a really robust system, in this case through an electronic platform through which people communicate, but to empower the providers of different care settings to communicate and collaborate with each other. But also, and I think the interesting thing is also the capacity building component. So in this model, and San Francisco General Hospital is one of the early pioneers in this area at University of California, San Francisco. And the way they conceived this was they had a problem with getting access to specialty care for their patients and felt like they needed to come up with some kind of solution that would reduce wait times, reduce the burden for patients on kind of navigating through this complex healthcare system, but also streamline and gain some efficiencies in the way specialty care was interacting with primary care. And using this electronic platform through which primary care providers and specialty care providers could interact, could talk directly about individual patient cases, and could actually connect through technology, they were able to drastically reduce wait times, but also increase the primary care physician capacity. Mm-hmm. Because what happened, and this was one of the byproducts of this model, initially it was designed merely to address access problems. We can't get people in, patients are waiting, patients are getting sicker because they're not getting access, there are long wait times. And the initial reaction was, well, once we do this, we can actually reduce the number of people that are requiring and demanding specialty care access by giving many more people access to specialty expertise. And once we do that, we can reduce the ultimate burden on the system. But what happened as a result of that was also that primary care providers were getting this incredible transfer of knowledge, mm-hmm. that every time they would have an interaction with a specialty care provider. So for example, if you wanted to ask a rheumatologist about the appropriate workup for, you know, a patient that came in with muscle aches, you could pose that question and they would give you the guidance on what that workup should look like. But what happened was that you would learn in that process. Mm-hmm. So not only would you go and order the tests that were required or think through what the differential diagnosis was, but you would actually now be able to do that the next time it came up. Mm-hmm. And so if you were now asked again, if you were faced with a similar patient with similar symptoms, you could say, well, you know, I've already got some really good guidance from another electronic consult. I know what they're going to ask me to do, and I could go ahead and do that. So I think in that regard, the capacity building for the primary care providers, also kind of defining that network and coordinating care through technology, but improving the way people communicated, was fascinating.
Yeah.
So that's a really good example. But another one that I'll describe, mm-hmm. has been training, like in the oral health bucket, training people who were not professionals in a certain area to have a new skill set. And when you first go and talk to a group of primary care providers and say, hi, I'm going to train you how to be really good at doing some oral health things, you know, you can imagine that how that goes, right? The first reaction is, no way, we're already busy. Yeah. We can't take on any more. Why are you bringing this to us? You know, have the dentist do it. But when you take it a step further and really have people realize that they can actually take on some of these things, it actually works really well. And so in one of the models we described, it was, you know, being able to say, well, what are some things that don't necessarily require a dental professional to do or the skill set of a dentist or a dental team to do? Could the primary care environment take on some of these things? So starting to train primary care providers, how do you screen for dental caries in children? How do you identify children who are at risk for having cavities or who are already, you know, experiencing problems with cavities? And what can you do in the primary care setting, assuming that dental services are limited? Getting access to dentists might take a long time. So being able to train both, how do you screen? And if you identify people that are at risk, can you apply, you know, a simple thing like a fluoride varnish, which can actually be put on in a primary care setting by a trained person, a medical assistant, a nurse, even a primary care provider, does not have to be a dentist. If we could actually own some of that in the medical home and build that capacity, you can, again, reduce the burden on the dental system and buy some time before people actually go and see the dentist. And in the meantime, you're preventing the caries or potentially providing some restorative services. So I think those are really good examples of both kind of this cross, the continuum of efforts between all these different components in our conceptual framework, mm-hmm. but also the power of building capacity.
Yeah, definitely. And can I ask you, specifically with the dental, dental training you just described, how did that come to be? How is it that the dentists are feeling that they are able to provide this training for the GPs? Are they part of a kind of a coordination network where they're looking to one another for how they can improve services? Or was it perhaps an overarching governance body that said, no, this is something you have to do? How did that training come about?
Well, that came about because I think it could come out in a number of ways. I think in this case, these are often systems that were already communicating. But if you're not a non-integrated system, there's not necessarily a robust framework through which the primary care and the oral health people are collaborating. A really good way to do this is actually to reach out to the places that you commonly refer to. You know, if you said, you know, as this clinic very often refers to these dentists, this group of dentists, reach out to the dental clinics and say, you know, we know we send you a lot of patients and we know we kind of, you know, add a lot of people into your queue. We're thinking of ways that we would like to really take on some of the, at least the screening and prevention that could be, you know, done in primary care. Would you be open to coming in and, you know, over lunch and training us in how to do some of these things? Mm. You'd be amazed at how many people actually would say yes to that.
Yeah.
Because one, you know, people like to share their professional expertise. They like to do it, but they definitely like to do it where it has meaning and has value. Mm. And if you're proposing a way that you're going to offload some of the things that they're being required to do and being asked to do and move that into another place and then allow them to be able to have the capacity to take on services that really require them, in many cases, they'll say yes. So that's a way to do it. I mean, in an integrated system where it's closed and everybody's interacting, it's easier. But this is definitely a way you could approach. And so I would say start with whoever you're referring to most commonly, you know, the people that get most of your patients by way of referral, mm-hmm. and reach out to them.
Mm, definitely. Okay, thanks for that. So moving on to the next question, what would you suggest from the, you know, I know you've done a whole, not just this paper, but a whole lot of work on both patient-centered medical home and integrated care. What would you suggest as your top tips for how you can integrate primary care and the myriad of services that they work with?
Yeah, I would say probably my biggest tip would be really being able to understand who is in the medical neighborhood and who are the people that you might need to build relationships with. One place that people tend to really forget and it ends up being harder to fix than it is to kind of do up front is in deciding what are the terms of engagement. So let's say we're going to coordinate care between this hospital and this primary care setting, or this specialty service provider in this primary care setting. A very good tool that people really underutilize are these compacts, where you can create some kind of agreement, and they're not like legal documents that are binding, but just agreement on what are the expectations if we're going to both provide care to this patient. Let's say we're, you know, and how are we gonna transition their care appropriately? So specialty care or care coordination compacts or contracts are really, really helpful and often underutilized. And I would say that's one of the most important things that you can do is decide, how do we work together? What are you going to be responsible for doing? Who is responsible for passing on information about a patient transition or changes in medications or things like that? And when are they responsible for doing that? What are we going to do when they receive it? And I think if you can establish that level of clarity, it seems very granular and very detailed, but if you can establish that level of clarity early on in a relationship, then as you start to work with people and get, you know, better, you are actually holding each other accountable for what you've already agreed on. And it's a lot easier to do that than to try to kind of find fault when things did not go well. So I would say, you know, it's hugely important to try to understand what are the expectations on both sides of whatever that relationship is, establish expectations early, kind of meet and review those expectations and hold each other accountable.
Definitely. And can I ask you in relation to patient-centered medical home? So I know that you're very aware that we're transitioning in Australia to a healthcare home model, or we're trialing it anyway. I've always seen that as an opportunity for primary care and for specialty services and allied health providers to actually connect, given that the key principles of healthcare homes are about coordination. I'm thinking that the time is kind of right in Australia to be talking about medical neighbourhoods and how we can build those relationships outside of general practice across, you know, the federal-state divide. Would you agree? Do you think there's an opportunity there, given the state of transition that we're in?
Yeah, I absolutely think there's an opportunity there, and I think when you're having the conversations about the patient-centered medical home or the healthcare home, it presents the perfect opportunity to actually expand the neighborhood. Because what you'll find is that when I've done a lot of work around the patient-centered medical home here in the U.S., and what we found is that you can really, truly get the buy-in at the medical home level, the primary care practice level, around the importance of focusing on the whole patient, being more efficient, being transparent with patients, organizing around care teams. You can get that buy-in pretty easily. But where you struggle is if the primary care medical home is doing really well in being patient-centered and focused on this level of transparency and integration, but anywhere the patient goes outside of that is not on the same page. And, you know, we can't really divide patients into your primary care only, your acute care only, your specialty care only, you know, your skilled nursing facility only, because at any given point, any patient could require any one of those services. And so the more you synchronize those services through the medical neighborhood integrations up front, the more you have buy-in. No matter where a patient goes, they're going to feel like they're getting the same level of attention. They're also going to know that people are communicating about their care and things aren't getting lost in their transition. So I think it's a perfect opportunity to try to do both really at the same time.
Yeah.
One of the biggest challenges that the primary care folks will say that they have when they are building these patient-centered medical homes is, I can do a great job here within this medical home, but once I send the patients out, if I don't have buy-in from people outside, then we're still delivering fragmented care. So I think you have to do both at the same time.
Yeah. And can I ask you, in your experience, those providers outside of primary care, do you feel that they have a good understanding of what a patient-centered medical home is, and do you think that's an important factor for them to understand the transition that primary care is undergoing and what that will actually mean for patients and their interactions as clinicians with the primary care providers?
Yeah, so the first question, no, I don't think there is enough of an interaction between them already. I don't think we've done a good enough job of making sure that everybody else understands what's happening in the primary care space. I have a lot of friends who are in hospitals or in specialty environments, and when I talk to them about it, it really is often a blind spot because they're not often included in the conversations. So to the second question, but I absolutely think it's important. I think it really is, you know, and that's part of why I think we've gotten where we have is because if we're not really explaining and kind of bringing people in to this model that we're adopting as we're doing it, then we can't really necessarily expect them to buy in. So if all of a sudden, you know, we decide as a primary care center that we think it's very important for us to integrate care and make sure that the hospitals really know what we're doing and that information gets to the hospitals, and all of a sudden you're just firing away all this information at hospitals, but they don't understand the context in which you're giving it to them, why you're doing it this way, you know, why they're getting this on-site information, then it becomes very, very difficult to get them to buy in and understand how to use what you're giving. So I think it's very important to make sure that we are communicating with all these other members of these medical neighborhoods. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. This is how we think it helps you as you're taking care of patients that we mutually care for. This is how we think it helps us. And I think if you can do that and have those conversations, you can get the buy-in, the understanding, and then the participation.
Absolutely. And in your experience, has that buy-in been readily available from those external providers, or has it been a bit of a hard slog?
I would say that it depends on when in the process you're looping them in. For the most part, everyone agrees philosophically with the notion of being more patient-centric and caring for people as whole person. I think if it's presented as the system has challenges, right? The system has challenges and we're not integrated well, as opposed to your hospital is a problem, or your specialty care center is not meeting our needs. I think it depends on how you're framing it. So when we're talking about, people are much more receptive to buying in if we're talking about structurally how the system is presenting challenges, but not placing blame on anybody for those challenges. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you're right.
So I think you buy in. People definitely agree. But if you go in and you're presenting this as, you know, we've sent you 40 patients and we haven't heard anything back because, you know, then automatically people are defensive and then you don't really end up getting where you're headed. But if you're presenting this as, we really want to create a better system for our patients, our patients, your patients, you know, to be able to and communicate and have, you know, stronger relationships and communication between us. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And not just with you, but with other people as well, other groups as well, then I think that gets you a lot further.
Sure. Look, I'm going to go a little bit off script just because I'm interested. look, we've been looking at accountable care organizations as an organization and doing some an evidence check of a few case studies across the globe. And one of the things that we've been hearing is that the benefit of an accountable care organization is that it does incentivize that collaboration. And I'm wondering if, given that we're not in a state at this stage of time to be building accountable care organizations in Australia, is it possible to achieve great things without necessarily having that financial incentive behind it?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I mean, I would say yes, I think so, because I think the key thing that the ACOs are doing is creating multi-level, multi-stakeholder buy-in and sharing of risk and accountability, as well as, you know, the successes, shared successes and shared rewards. So I think if you're able to do that and create that agreement on kind of mutual accountability, mutual incentive to be able to get somebody well, then I think you can do it probably without necessarily having the structure of the ACOs, because a lot of times those are very complicated in terms of agreements and arrangements. So a perfect example is, you know, you have a patient that has been seen. Let's say I'm a family doctor. Patients come and see me. And I'm talking to this person, middle-aged man, and I'm saying, you've got to stop smoking. I really want you to stop smoking. You know, you've got children and grandchildren. I think it's going to be great if you stop smoking. And I'm doing that as a primary care physician. And then they go to the hospital and unfortunately have a heart attack, and they're cared for by the hospital team. And the cardiologist comes in and says, you know, you've had a heart attack now. It's really time for you to stop smoking. And I think this is the time for you to do it. And now you know that the risk is real. And then, you know, and then a tobacco cessation person comes in and kind of gives them tools for how they're going to quit smoking. And ultimately this patient stops smoking. So from everybody's perspective, that success was theirs. For me as a family doctor, I think I'm so glad I started to talk to him about smoking, because I planted that seed in him a long time ago, right? And I'd had him at a stage of contemplation even before his heart attack. The cardiologist thinks, I'm so glad I got this guy to stop smoking, because when he had this heart attack, I scared him. I talked to him about that this could happen again, and he really got scared at that point, and that was it. And the tobacco cessation person is saying, I'm the one that got the patient to stop smoking, because once they, you know, yeah, they had the heart attack, yeah, the primary doctor talked to them, but I really gave them the actual tools, right? And no one's actually wrong. And so I think if you're thinking about a way of saying, we all share that success, that's what the ACOs are trying to do. We all share that success. Who's really responsible for this guy stopping, you know, quitting tobacco use? It's really all of us. And we can all share in that success, and the savings to our system are all of ours. That's what they're trying to do. But if you're able to replicate kind of that sense of shared responsibility and accountability for a patient without the kind of that structure, then I think you get at the same thing. I hope that's a helpful analogy.
Yeah, it is. And look, it's interesting in terms of timing. Australia are also looking at doing increasing amounts of data linkage between primary care and our hospitals, which to date has not been so great. So I think that concept of we all share the success is going to be made a lot clearer when we can actually see the ramifications of what happens in primary care and how it flows on to what happens in hospitals or in allied health or wherever. So I think that's a really strong motivation, that concept of sharing the success, and that it's not just the last person who speaks to someone that's actually responsible for the outcome. No, thank you. I thought that was brilliant. All right. Look, we might finish up there. I wanted to finish up with just asking if you, I know you're familiar with the New South Wales context. You've been here a couple of times. You had any advice for providers in New South Wales about how they might go about developing local integrated healthcare neighbourhoods.
Yeah, what I would say is that don't try to do too much too quickly. You know, as we were talking about earlier, there are probably relationships that already exist that you could use to actually set up what does the construct look like, as opposed to trying to build, you know, relationships and formal compacts and agreements with a million other people. Try to say, where do we have really strong relationships already? Could we leverage those relationships that exist and actually build a very good partnership and figure out what does it look like to actually integrate between these two entities? What would that look like? What are the materials that we need to develop that we share? How do we kind of come to shared goals? How do we come to shared metrics so we look at success? What kind of agreements do we need to do that? And try to develop that with one or two groups that you know and work with already. I would say that's really the place to start, because then you have a chance. One, you have a willing partner and someone that's equally bought in, and then you can build and refine and define and refine what you're doing and how you operate, so that when you're ready to actually bring that kind of model to more entities or more groups, you have a really good model that you're bringing. And I think what happens a lot of times, people say, okay, well, we have clinics in three different parts of this, you know, the city of San Francisco, for example. So we need to reach out and form relationships with Kaiser, with CPMC, and with UCSF right away, because we need to get, you know, we need to have all of us working together. Mm-hmm. Our patients go to any of these hospitals when they get sick. And then you end up doing too much and maybe biting off more than you can chew and not really getting anyone really, really right. So a better way to do that would say, these are the three major hospitals that our patients go to. We really want to, you know, develop a really good operating model through which we can communicate and collaborate. How do we do that? And why don't we approach one of them and start to really work this out and develop what this looks like, and then we have something to present to the other ones. And that's the approach that I strongly recommend when you're trying to build kind of local integrated systems.
Mm. Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time, Nando. I cannot tell you how much we appreciate it. And hopefully we'll see you next time you're in Sydney.
Fabulous. Well, keep up the great work. Thank you
Oh,
so
no,
much
great.
for chatting with me.
Not at all. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced by the New South Wales Agency for Clinical Innovation through its Navigating the Healthcare Neighbourhood program. For more information, just type Navigating the Healthcare Neighbourhood into Google and visit our website.